Welcome, one and all, to Populist. Thank you for joining us. This is episode 35. I'm Steve Hafer, and with me is the home plate to my goal line. It's Kirk Tridner. How's it going, Kirk?
I see what you did there. You're not playing around.
It's just a game to you.
Well, today it's going to be a game for everybody because episode 35, our top 10 list today is all about the greatest sports venues in the world.
Ooh.
Yeah. A little bit different. We've done sports before, but we haven't really dived into venues or dove into venues.
I don't know what the correct term for that is.
Do you dive into diving venues? Do you dove into diving venues? How does this work?
Gaggle. No, wait, that's wrong.
That's a search engine.
A covey. Wait. Dive, dove, cove. I don't know.
Either way, are you ready to tee it up? Are you ready to get your engine started?
Oh.
You ready to kick it off?
Nice. I see what you're doing there.
Ready to take a swing? Yes.
Keep it coming. This is going to be a slam dunk. That's all I know.
Oh, touch down.
So let's put this on ice and talk about what you use for your criteria for this wide-ranging subject.
This one was fun. I actually learned a lot more about venues around the world than I might have thought because as you and I talked about, it was really easy at the start of this process for this show to be very geocentric, to be very, you know, just know the venues that we know here in the United States. It was also very easy to be sports-centric, baseball, college football, you know, not only two of our favorite pastimes, but, you know, that's where the great venues are. So what I wanted to really look at, history, were there iconic moments that took place there? Do they have traditions? I don't necessarily, you know, spoiler alert, my first unlisted, I don't have a venue like SoFi Stadium here in LA on mine just because it hasn't been around long enough. Is it a good venue? Isn't it? You know, 20, 30, 40 years, that the venue is just starting to get its character. It's just starting to build a reputation. So that was really, you know, kind of where I started and then radiated out from. What about you?
Yeah, I too don't have SoFi or US Bank Stadium, which is the Viking Stadium in Minneapolis, which I consider to be the two new cathedrals of football. You know, they're high tech. They tuck tons of creature comforts and, you know, a lot of extras that come along with it. But yeah, they just don't have a track record for those momentous events, with the exception of SoFi having just had a Super Bowl recently. So, you know, most of the places that we're going to talk about are in their own way, some sort of way, the pinnacle of sports venues. So, you know, for me, I just was hoping that it was kind of oozing with a little history. And I usually tend to gravitate toward places where you can almost like feel the ghosts
absolutely
roaming around, or you can feel the moments of history, the moments of yesteryear. So I kind of went to that. And I, like you, also tried to break away from just being about America.
I tried, yeah,
tried to look at some other stuff, you know. So it'll be interesting to see what our lists are all about. Do you feel good about yours?
I do. Did you find yourself as you were doing this? Like, I found two or three where I almost wanted to do cheats for all of them because they're almost the exact same thing. And then, you know, you go, all right, I'm going to do one or the other, right? You know, so I just found there was a lot more than we'd normally have.
That's funny. You just said, I wanted to do cheats. So are you admitting to us right now that you, Kirk Trudner, have no cheats? Or are you not admitting that? Are you going to play close to the vest?
I don't think I have a cheat.
Well, you'd never do. The entire Newman family. Yes.
Okay. Space.
Yeah, but you like that one, dude.
I did, but I like cheats. So who better to judge?
Good point. Good point. All right. Well, considering the variety of the topic, and even though there are a lot of things to think about, you and I tend to kind of somewhat think along the same lines. So let's talk about
the over under.
And on the over under, it's going to be a little interesting, but I'm going to play it a little safe. And for common listings for over under, I'm going to say 4.5. We will have, that is the over under.
Ooh.
For common listings.
Ooh. Wow. I'm going to go over, but like you always do, I'm going to go over only because I think it's five.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
I think it's going to be five.
That's fair enough. I think you might be right. We'll see. Now for the exact matches, just as you said, I don't want to give you the complete field, so I'm going to say 1.5.
Well, last week you got me just purely blind draw when St. Elsewhere was number 8. We could have done the list 100 times, and I don't think that would have happened again. Yeah. I'm gonna go under.
Oh, actually, I kind of thought you would.
I'm gonna go on. It depends on how much of a homer you are.
Hmm. Oh, okay. I get what you mean. Well, you might be surprised.
Uh huh.
You might be surprised.
You picking up what I'm putting down?
I am, but you might All be right. surprised. All right. So we will figure that out as we go along, but that brings us to
Unlisted.
And in the Unlisted segment, this is where Kirk and I give a little sneak peek of what will not be on our lists today. Kirk, what will be not appearing on your list?
Not on my list will be Old Yankee Stadium, not the new one. The new one's not on there either. So let's say either Yankee Stadiums. Neither one of those are going to be on there. The Nest, the Beijing National Stadium, featured in the Olympics. They will not. And just because I can, Dodger Stadium will not be on my list.
Wow. One of those really surprises me. Dodger Stadium is not that one. That's funny. For my Unlisted, I will not be raising the historic ghosts of Old Boston Garden, the Old Montreal Forum, where the Canadians won so many Stanley Cups, or the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field. None of those will be on my list today.
All right. Strangely enough, they will not appear on mine either. So we may have a nice varied list going on here. This is great.
Yes, but I will already give a little sneak peek that one of your Unlisted is on my list.
Ooh.
Ooh.
All right. Shall we start it off?
Let's do it.
Good luck to you and good luck to those venues that are competing for spots in our top 10 list this week. And that brings us to
number 10.
So to get us started, I'm going to actually go out of the country. We talked about a lot of our choices maybe being here in the United States, but I'm going to start overseas. We're going to go over to the Principality of Monaco, because my number 10 is the Monaco circuit for the Grand Prix of Monaco. Now, yes, this may stretch our definition of venue a little bit, but people can attend. The event is held, and it's all held in downtown Monte Carlo and in the Principality of Monaco. It's a 2-mile circuit that goes through the city streets. I mean, literally, when it's over, they pull the barricades away and people can drive through the city again. It's almost like racing's Brigadoon, Formula One's Brigadoon. This is the Grand Prix that every Formula One driver wants to win. It's glitzy. It's glamorous. It's a remarkable scene set in this historic part of Monaco. It is a beautiful venue. It is a beautiful event. And the Monaco circuit is my number 10.
Great choice. Just missed my list because, as you know, when we talked about greatest sports events and everything, that was high on my list and did make my list. I'll tell you sometime when we have when we're off air about trying to get tickets for the place, because I'm going to Europe soon and I thought it was going to time out that I was going to get to go to Monaco. And as it is, I'm going to miss it. I'll be in the city like 3 days after the race. But I was trying to find things, and the amounts of tickets that are available, the varied situations that you can buy, like you could be in the grandstands, you can just be roaming around, you can be at a hotel with a balcony, you can be on one of the yachts. They rent out yacht space for you to stand there with a party going on. And the dollar range is incredible.
Of course they do.
Incredible. So good choice on your part. I love it.
Well, I wonder if it's like golf courses after they host a major event. They charge a little extra for the couple weeks after, so regular people can play a course the way it was set up for a major. Maybe they'll leave it up, and when you're there, you can drive a car on the course.
Well, like, because I used to sail out of Long Beach, California, and after the Long Beach Grand Prix, which is an IndyCar circuit, everything would still be up. And so I actually drove on the course a couple of times as I was leaving the sailing venue. So I'm anticipating that Monaco will still be, you know, a lot in that shape as I go to the casino to check out the James Bond location and all that stuff.
Ooh. You're gonna play James Bond over there, aren't you? You're gonna put on a tuxedo. You're gonna get a martini. You're gonna sit around the baccarat table.
It's gonna be great.
Nice. All right. What's your number 10?
My number 10 is the founding father of multi-purpose dome stadiums, nicknamed the eighth wonder of the world. It's the Astrodome. It's no longer used for professional sports, but it did have quite a history when it was around. It was built in 1962, or actually from 1962 to 1965. But it served as home from 1965 to 1999 for the Houston Astros. It was also the home for the NFL Houston Oilers, part-time home for the NBA Rockets from 71 to 75. And it's the first major sports venue to install artificial turf, henceforth the name AstroTurf, which artificial turf was called for many, many years. It was home for the Houston Rodeo until 2002. It's been home for an NBA All-Star Game, a Republican National Convention in 1992, and it saw the game of the century in college basketball, which pitted Elvin Hayes' University of Houston Cougars versus Lou Alcindor and John Wooden's UCLA Bruins. It was the home for the famous Battle of the Sexes tennis match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. WWE wrestling, Muhammad Ali fought Cleveland Williams there in 1966, and a ton of high-ranking concerts like Elvis, The Stones, Pink Floyd, U2. It's the Astrodome.
I think it's a given that with almost every place that we're going to mention, most everyone, concerts are a big part of the history of a lot of these places as well. Exactly. But I also have to wonder, do you have any statistics on how many careers were cut short because of the crappy AstroTurf?
No, too much to count.
Great choice.
Let's move on.
Number 9.
My number 9 is home to an event that the legendary writer Dan Jenkins called 500 Left-Hand Turns and a Bottle of Milk. My number 9 is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, which was constructed in 1909. Went on the National Register of Historic Places in 1975. It became a National Historic Landmark in 1987. And it has permanent seating for 257,000 spectators. It's the highest capacity sports venue in the world. To give you an example of how big this piece of property is, 253 acres, all of the following would fit inside the infield: Vatican City, Yankee Stadium, the White House, Taj Mahal, Churchill Downs, the Rose Bowl, the Roman Coliseum, and Liberty Island. This is a massive setup, but it needs it. It is one of the historic racing venues in the world, if not the most, and it hosts the most historic race in the world as well. It is uniquely American. It is all about Memorial Day. It is the Brickyard, and it is Indianapolis Motor Speedway, my number 9.
Interesting. You picked a racetrack. Wow. I didn't.
I'm 2 for 2 with racetracks.
Another racetrack, I should say. All right. My number 9 is a racetrack, but it's just not the ones you've talked about. It's Churchill Downs, the Louisville, Kentucky site of the annual Run for the Roses, the Kentucky Derby. Opened in 1875, the track with its marquee grandstands and added twin spires, which they built back in 1895, has lured millions of guests to sip mint juleps, show off their finest fashionable hats, and take in the yearly tradition that is the Kentucky Derby. Churchill Downs hosts other marquee races also, such as the Kentucky Oaks, the Turf Classic Stakes, and the Breeders' Cup World Championships, which they've done 8 times. It's been a name-making place. We remember the race. It's something that television and race fans, horse race fans, gear for every year. So names like Kent DeSormo, Bill Shoemaker, Gary Stevens, horses like War Admiral, Seattle Slough, Secretariat are all historic names from historic events and a historic venue, Churchill Downs in Louisville, Kentucky.
And we are off to the races.
Yes, we are.
Nice choice. I didn't put it on my list. It was close. It's one of the ones we'll talk about a little bit later on. But for all the reasons you listed, I can absolutely see a reason to put it in the top 10.
I got a chance to tour it once when I was in Louisville. And it's just a fascinating place. And it's one of those places you can feel the history. It's palpable. You can sense the ghosts of the past.
I can imagine. I can only imagine. Nice choice.
Thank you. All right. Ever upward, it brings us to
Number 8.
My number 8 is the largest stadium in the Southern Hemisphere. It is a 100,000 seat facility that remains the home of Australian football and cricket. It is the Melbourne Cricket Ground, built in 1853, Melbourne, Australia. Greg Baum, who is a noted writer, sports writer in Australia, called the cricket ground a shrine, a citadel, a landmark, a totem that symbolizes Melbourne to the world. And according to the website, and I like the way they worded this, the Melbourne Cricket Ground has assumed an identity beyond that of a sporting venue. It's important to the community. Importance to the community lies in experiencing the place through the events it hosts. And while it is called a cricket ground, it is the principal venue for the Australian rules football matches. The AFL Grand Final is held there. It's the last Saturday in September. And it's the highest attended league championship event in the world. 121,000 actually saw it in 1970. It hosts concerts. It hosts rugby. It hosts cricket. It even hosted the Olympic Games. In fact, the Melbourne Olympics were held during a period of extreme international tension. And the games became known as the Friendly Games. And so this hosting venue, this hosting city, left an enduring legacy, not only for Australia, but also for the Olympic movement by kind of cooling tensions at these games. It is a part venue, part shrine to Australian sports. It is legendary in Australia, and I think we need to find out a little bit more about it here in the States. That's why I'm making it my number eight.
We need to find out about the stadium we're in here in the States or the game of cricket?
Both.
All right. You first. All right. Very good. I had a feeling you'd pull something like that out of your bag.
Those are for all of our Australian listeners.
Racetracks. All right. My number eight is, all right, sure, it's another racetrack. It is. It's a track that's a little different. It is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway that Kirk just talked about. I agree with everything you said. I like the fact that it is different, that it's not the oval, that it has the four distinct corners and it's 2.5 mile long track. It was built originally as a dirt track way back when, and the drivers had so many problems with it, and they were covered with dirt and grime and oil and everything. People were killed on one race that they said, okay, we have to change things. They paved it, and then it's become the legend that it is. You know, millions of people tune in every Memorial Day weekend to watch the festivities of the Indy 500. Names like the Andretti's, AJ Foyt, the Unser family, Emerson Fittipaldi, and so many others have always made history during that weekend with that Indy 500. It's also been home to the NASCAR Brickyard 500 since 1994. They added an infield road course. Kirk was talking about the size. It's so big, they added an infield road course for Formula One to race the U.S. Grand Prix there from 2000 to 2007. It's had motorcycle racing, smaller Grand Prix, and Indy Light circuit events. It's just has a ton of tradition during race days, such as the Purdue marching band, the singing of back home in Indiana, drinking of the milk, kissing of the bricks. It's a place that all this happens, and it is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
It is uniquely American. I'm not a race fan. Certainly, I don't think as much as you are, but it is still a race that I will tune in to watch. It's one of those destination appointment viewing events, sporting events that we have in the United States. And it's certainly, you know, one I'll watch, even though I truly don't understand it to save my life.
Yeah. And where I've become a big Formula One fan in the past few years, my whole life, the Indianapolis 500 and Monaco were the two races that I would watch all the time. Sometimes the Daytona 500 as well, but Indy 500, numero uno. All right. Moving forward, it brings us to
number seven.
My number seven is one of England's most renowned and extravagant sporting venues. It was founded in 1868, and it is the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club. Most everybody here in the States generally just calls it Wimbledon, not realizing that it's the tournament that's known as Wimbledon, not the facility itself. Again, founded in 1868, it moved to its current location in 1922. The first championship tennis event was held there in 1877, which eventually became Wimbledon. And people say, what was the All England Club, as it's shortened and known now, be without Wimbledon? And I would say, what would Wimbledon be without the All England Club? It was the All England Club that actually drew up the first formal rules for the game of tennis, the court size, the scoring, which was based on a clock face, the idea that the first player to win six games wins a set, allowing the serve to have one fault. I mean, this is where the game of tennis began and grew in England. Wimbledon, known as the championship, I think it's the most coveted and prestigious event in all of tennis. And in some ways, the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club is very much like Augusta here in the United States, in that it is not a national governing body, but it still puts on one of the majors. The French Open, the Australian Open, the US Open are all done by national entities, but it is the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club that puts on Wimbledon. It's also the only major that's still done on grass. And it's just steeped in tradition and etiquette. And just, you know, we've watched Wimbledon for years. We know what it's all about. It's beautiful. It's extravagant. It's royalty. It's curtsying to the crown. It's strawberries and cream. It's all that good stuff. And let's face it, Chris Tortolano would kill us if we did not put Wimbledon and the All England Tennis Club on here. So the All England Lawn and Tennis Club, now known as the All England Club, is my number seven.
Chris, you cannot kill us now. Kirk saved us both. All right. We said it.
At least for another week.
Yes. good choice. And little point of clarification, the reason it's called Wimbledon is because that's the area that the club is at, is Wimbledon, whether that's a township or
actually
an actual part of London.
I will clarify your clarification. It was originally built in Wimbledon, and now it has moved.
Yes.
Inward. So it originally started at Wimbledon. That's how it took the name. And now that it's moved to its new location in 1922, they kept the name from where they came.
Yes. Yes. Correct. Very good. My number seven is coming back across the pond to the States. And I'm going to talk about a venue that opened in 1922. And it's been recognized as a National Historic Landmark and a California Historic Civil Engineering Landmark. And that is the amazing venue known as the Rose Bowl. It seats over 92,500 people and has hosted many, many events. It's been home to UCLA football since 1982. It's hosted many soccer games, both collegiate pro and U.S. national team matches, including the finals for the 1994 FIFA World Cup and the 1999 Women's World Cup and the 1984 Olympic soccer gold medal game. Its obvious main claim to fame is the hosting of the annual Rose Bowl game for college football in January since 1922. And pretty much every year, except for 1942, where it was interrupted for World War II, and 2021, because of California COVID restrictions, it had to move to Texas. Some of the Rose Bowls have also been playoff or championship games as well for college football. It's a venue that shows off its symmetry, its beautiful oval, and its outward beauty during the Rose Bowl game as day slips into sunset, then dusk. And if you ever watched it on TV, it's just absolutely gorgeous. It's the Rose Bowl, one of college football's finest stadiums.
I love the Rose Bowl. In fact, I live only about 10 minutes from it.
That's right.
Went to a UCLA game last year. It's a great venue. It's a wonderful venue. It's so unique. You can't really tell on TV, but the rake, the angle of the seats as they move backwards, back away from the field, is really not very pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels like this wonderful low slung dish in the hills or bowl in the hills.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, it's in a beautiful little part of the San Gabriel Valley. It's got trees all around it. When it's sunset, it's just gorgeous. So absolutely belongs on the top 10.
So please tell me you went to go see a UCLA game because the Cal Bears were playing, or did you lose at a tremendous bet or something?
I wouldn't say that the Cal played. Okay. I think they were there. Well,
they were the other team involved.
They got kind of boat raced, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
A lot of beers were drank that night.
All is forgiven. All right. That handled our first four and brings us into
number six.
For my number six, there were a lot of great football venues to choose from. Camp Nou, Santiago Bernabeu, Old Trafford. But without a doubt, the most iconic stadium in the world for what the rest of the world calls football is Wembley Stadium in England. It is the most famous stadium for the sport of soccer, football, which is the most popular sport in the entire world. So ergo, it needs to be on this list. Wembley was originally built in 1923. It was rebuilt in 2007. 90,000 seats. It's the largest sports venue in the United Kingdom, the second largest in Europe. It's been the host to 78 FA Cup finals, six European Cup finals, one World Cup. It also hosts the annual League Cup final, FA Cup final, the Community Shield. Again, the Olympics were done there as well. Concerts, including very memorable benefits for those of us of a certain age. The Human Rights Now concert in 1988, the Freddie Mercury concert in 1992, and of course, Live Aid in 1985. I will venture to guess, though, that most listeners probably know Wembley Stadium as the stadium where the NFL plays their singular game in Europe every year. It is a multi-purpose venue. It is the pride of England, and it is just a remarkable place that continues to endure. In 1923, they built the venue with Twin Towers as their signature. In 2007, they replaced that with the Wembley Arch. It is significant. It is historic. It is a big part of European football, and it is my number six, Wembley Stadium.
Wembley. We're going to Wembley today to take in a match.
Wembley.
Good stadium. Big place.
I just want to point out that my first five are two racetracks, a cricket pitch, a soccer field, and a tennis court.
And only one of them are from the United States.
That's exactly it.
Who knew? What have you done with Kirk Treutner, pod person? All right. My number six is, what was your number seven? And that is the All England Lawn and Tennis and Croquet Club. You said a lot of it, so I'm not going to beat this one up too much, but I just remember being a kid and watching my first Wimbledon match, and I believe it was an Arthur Ashe match that I was watching, and just going, wow, what are they playing on? What is it? And my dad was saying, that's grass. I went, that's grass? Because as an American kid, especially in California, you know this grass that you have, and it's, you know, a little bit longer and thick and everything. And you're going, how can a tennis ball bounce on grass? So I was fascinated by that whole concept. But play on grass they do, and they've been hosting the championship since 1877, which is just a mind blow. They hosted tennis events for the 1908 Summer Olympics. They've occasionally hosted a Davis Cup finals as well. The place was damaged by German bombing in World War II. It was also targeted but defended from an arsonist during the suffragette bombing and arson campaign of 1913. Who even knew there was such a thing? But you know what? You got to watch out for those suffragettes. And Wimbledon protected the goods.
If mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy.
And mama wasn't happy. Traditions like the all-white dress code for the players, strawberries and cream, and the royal viewing box are well known, as are the champions like Borg, Everett, Ashe, Navratilova, Connors, Graf, McEnroe, the Williams sisters. It's a one of a kind. It's the All England Club. And it's my number six.
Yeah, it had to be there, right? We had to put it on our list, right?
I kind of think so.
Yeah.
I kind of think so.
I mean, it's one of those places.
No, you know, disrespect intended to Roland Garros or, you know, some of the other top tennis venues, but yeah, All England. I think that's the one.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Good choice.
Okay. We are one away from our Mount Rushmore, and it brings us into
number five.
My number five is a venue that has been demolished and rebuilt four times in three different locations. The current version of it opened in February of 1968, and it is in the city that never sleeps, Madison Square Garden. It's home to three different New York City teams, the Knicks, the Liberty, and the Rangers. Great boxing matches have taken place there. The one I'll call out, because I don't know if you've got this on your list as well, but the Ali Frazier fight, 1971, Ali Frazier won. Two great fun stats I read about this. People could not get tickets to this. So even celebrities, well-known celebrities, had to find other ways of getting in. Burt Lancaster ended up doing color commentary for the closed circuit broadcast of the fight. And Frank Sinatra couldn't get in. So he volunteered to Life magazine to be a photographer for them that night. Everybody wanted in. Madison Square Garden is one of those places that, even though we live on the West Coast, we have known about and have watched games and events and celebrations happen there all of our lives. And as good as the athletic stuff has been, the concerts that have been held there pretty much on par as well, all the way back to the concert for Bangladesh in 1971, organized by George Harrison, the concert for New York City following 9/11 in 2001, the No Nukes concerts in 1979. Billy Joel has played the Garden more than 130 times, and the Garden was the last major concert appearance for John Lennon in 1974 when he joined Elton John on stage. It's in a spectacular location, Midtown Manhattan, and any venue that can trace its history back to 1879 and opened by P.T. Barnum has got to find a way on the list somehow. So my number five is the Circled Square, Madison Square Garden.
You would think it would have to find on your, its way onto your list, but sadly, it just missed mine. Very close, though. I guess I blame the Knicks and the Rangers if they were better. Just kidding.
Damn that Willis Reed.
Well, they were great back then. I'm not faulting that team. That team
was
great.
Damn that Patrick Ewing. Damn that Jeremy Lin.
Keep bringing it forward. All right. My number five is another very historic venue, but from a completely different sport. It's from the sport of baseball, and that is the friendly confines of Wrigley Field. Opened in 1914, the ivy-colored walls, the view of Chicago and Lake Michigan, the day games, the Babe calling his shot during the World Series, Ernie Banks' famous Let's Play 2 speech. This is the last stadium to install lights, and it's seen a lot of history, and it's been part of a lot of history. It's the oldest park in the National League, has the iconic hand-turned scoreboard and divisional flags and the famous win and loss flags that go up after each game. The rooftop seats on the neighboring buildings that surround it, you can't find that anywhere else. And it's been home for the Cubs since 1916. It also served as the home for the football Chicago Bears between 1921 and 1970, and the football Chicago Cardinals from 1931 through 38 before they moved to St. Louis and then eventually to Arizona. Northwestern University and Illinois University have both played football games there, as well as soccer games, plenty of concerts. Wrigley has hosted a lot of stuff. No other park in the world looks like Wrigley or has its feel within its neighborhood, and it's kind of a community park. It's like the neighborhood that surrounds it. It's always evolving. In 1927, they added the upper deck. 1937, they added the ivy vines. 1988, they added lights, and the renovation keeps changing and enhancing the park itself. You know I love this place, being a Cub fan. Wrigley Field, my number five.
Man, I had a chance to visit Wrigley for the first time a couple of years ago with our friends Doug Arniakoski and John Leering, a friend of the podcast, and it was just enthralling. You know, being a baseball fan, it was just, you know, one of those bucket lists you have to do in your lifetime kind of things. And we took in a couple of games, got the weather, rode the L, you know, visited Wrigleyville. I mean, it's just spectacular. It has every right to be on this list. It is one of the true greats in the United States and in the world. So I'm so glad you found room for Wrigley. Not surprised, but glad.
Yeah. it feels like a larger ballpark than it is because it's much more open than a Fenway or some other places. You can see more. And if there's anything that the current Cubs administration or ownership is doing well, is they are constantly making it better, making the surrounding area better. It's just getting better and better and not feeling old and dilapidated. So kudos to that. All right. We're about to go into our Mount Rushmore. So let's do a little recap, which we haven't done in a while. Our 10 through fives. At number 10, I had the Astrodome. Number 9 was the horse racing track Churchill Downs in Louisville. Number 8 was the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The Rose Bowl was at number 7. All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club at number 6. And the Chicago Cubs home stadium of Wrigley Field in Chicago, my number 5. Kirk, what were yours?
I started at number 10 with the Monaco Circuit, which is the racetrack for the Grand Prix of Monaco. Number 9 was the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, which Steve had on his list as well. Number 8 was the Melbourne Cricket Ground from Melbourne, Australia. Number 7 was the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club, again, like Steve had on his list. Wembley Stadium was my number 6, and Madison Square Garden was my number 5.
Okay, and that brings us into
Mount Rushmore.
And as always, the Mount Rushmore is where we separate the best from the rest. It is our top four favorites, the ones that we thought just deserve a little special highlighting. And we will begin with the first of the four faces of Mount Rushmore.
Number four.
My number four is a venue that you've already mentioned. It was your number seven, and it is the Rose Bowl here in Southern California. Celebrating a century of being the, quote, granddaddy of them all. Now, I'm stealing a little bit from the nickname of the Rose Bowl game itself, but this is one of the most famous venues in sporting history. And a little bit of trivia, I didn't realize this, that the stadium name, the Rose Bowl, actually gave rise to the term bowl game for all college postseason games and the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Rose Bowl was the first one, they just decided to call all of these bowl games after that. The current capacity for the venue is right around 91,000, but it holds attendance records for the Super Bowl. 1980, they had 103,000 people for the Super Bowl. And for a regular college football game, which was 100,000, which was the SC-UCLA game in 1988. As we talked about before, the setting is sublime, nestled in the San Gabriel Mountains. I think you mentioned some of this, and if I'm repeating it, I apologize, but five Super Bowls, two Olympics, a BCS championship, World Cup final, lots of concerts. It's a national historic landmark. I got to tell you, for the longest time, I actually had the Big House, the Michigan Stadium, on my top 10 and almost on my Mount Rushmore until I just started doing a little bit more digging on the Rose Bowl. Because, you know, when you look at the Big House, one of my favorite statistics is on game day, if it's sold out, that stadium is the seventh largest city in Michigan. I mean, it's huge. It is monstrous. But the Rose Bowl, honestly, just for the tradition, the fact that the Rose Bowl is held there. And I joke that every year I know that January 1st or whatever day the Rose Bowl is on is going to be beautiful weather because it never fails. People see the Rose Bowl on TV. They're living in Ottumwa, Iowa, or Michigan, or Minnesota, freezing their ass. And they're looking at the TV going, we got to move to California. That's the biggest reason. I've always thought so. Anyway, the Rose Bowl, it's a wonderful venue. It's delightful to drive by. It's great to see a game in. And it's my first face of Mount Rushmore, number four.
Yeah, it's a great stadium. And I hear you about the Big House. The Big House got a lot of consideration for me, as did Notre Dame University field or Notre Dame Stadium, because both those places steep in tradition. You can feel the ghosts and the ghosts of history. So, yeah, any of which would have been worthy. My number four is also something that you mentioned before. It was your number six, and that is Wembley Stadium in England. As Kirk said, if soccer and football is the world's game, this is the most famous venue within that game. First known as Empire Stadium, Wembley Stadium is both iconic in structure as it is in history. Hosted five European Cup finals, the 1966 World Cup final, the finals of Euro 96, the Euro Cup and World Cup qualifiers. It's hosted rugby, Challenge Cup finals, Greyhound and motorcycle racing, the WWF. As Kirk mentioned, the 11 NFL games have been there. Evel Knievel has jumped buses there. Muhammad Ali has had a match there. And it was the main venue for the 1948 Summer Olympics. It's home for one of the oldest soccer competitions, the FA Cup. It doesn't host a Premier League club, but it used to be home for Arsenal in the Champions League. Brazilian star Pele once said, "Wembley is the cathedral of football. It is the capital of football. It is the heart of football." That's good enough for me. Wembley Stadium, the heart of football / soccer.
Good answer. Nice first face.
All right, moving on.
Number three.
My number three is the home of your San Francisco Giants. Number three for me is Oracle Park in San Francisco, California. Yes, I'm a homer. Yes, I'm a Giants fan. Yes, I'm from the Bay Area. But I defy anybody who's been to the park to deny that it is the most beautiful setting for any of the stadiums in the four professional sports leagues in the United States, if not around the world. A visit to Oracle Park is absolutely amazing. It's only 22 years old, but when you consider the amount of history it already has, three World Series, Matt Cain's perfect game, Travis Ishikawa walking off a home run to win the pennant, the splash hits out into McCovey Cove, Bonds broke the home run record there. Save your cards and letters, everybody. It is absolutely extraordinary. The baseball that's been played there and continues to be played there. 107 win season last season. But the baseball is just one part of it. The game day experience is absolutely amazing. The Walk of Fame, the knot hole walls in the outfield, McCovey Cove, the best fans in baseball. Again, yes, I'm biased, but whenever you've got Steve Perry singing Don't Stop Believing in the bottom of an inning in the playoff game, that's a pretty good fan base to have. Great concessions. The food is second to none. The cha-cha bowl, the garlic fries, the exceptional craft beers from Anchor Steam and the vastly underrated 21st Amendment Brewery, the surroundings of the park. Again, the area has been completely gentrified since it opened in 2000. So you've got the Public House, Paragons, Momo's, Chase Center, the Warriors' new home, has opened less than a half a mile away. And all that territory in between the two venues is being developed. It's a remarkable experience. It is baseball at its finest. If you didn't know better, you'd say this ballpark was built 100 years ago and not 20 years ago. I'm so lucky to be able to call it my ballpark, and Oracle Park is my number three.
Interesting, Mr. Bond. It's a arguable point, but you might very well be right about it stacking up to other venues for its beauty. I don't know if the big Coke bottle helps its beauty necessarily, but I give it high marks in its originality, in using the space that they're in. McCovey Cove is definitely a cool thing. People know about the park because of that, because they see the people on the kayaks waiting to retrieve home run balls, so forth. And it is a great experience there, no doubt about it. It is a fantastic ballpark. I'm just giving you a little bit of guff, but I don't know. Ivy colored walls, they're kind of pretty.
Yes, they are.
All right. I had a feeling it was going to show up in your list. You did not disappoint. My number three is something that I have a feeling will also be on your list somewhere here. And that is our first venture into the world of golf. And that is the Augusta National Golf Club, where St. Andrews was very viable also. And I almost pulled a Kirk cheat here. I'm just going to lean on the side of Augusta National. Opened in 1932, designed by Bobby Jones and Alistair McKenzie. It's hosted the Masters Golf Tournament since 1934. It's top-ranked course in Golf Digest list of 100 greatest American courses in 2009. It's the only course to permanently host one of the PGA's four major tournaments, the Masters, each year. The other tournaments are rotating. They go from different course to different course. It's known for its beauty and its serenity and its famed azaleas and dogwoods. One little fun fact, which I didn't know until I researched, is that they actually have speakers spread out through the golf course, and they pump in sounds of soothing bird song on the course to help with its image. Love that.
I have his album.
he's had many.
They don't play that drippy piano music all the time.
Nope,
there.
Nope. It's Bird Song, the greatest hits album. When sections of the course have names like Amen Corner, Ray's Creek, the Hogan and Nelson Bridges, the Butler Cabin, the Eisenhower Tree, you're a pretty esteemed venue. These little places are all well known also amongst the golf circles. The course gets a TV viewership between 13 and 16.8 million viewers every time the Masters final round appears. It's very well known. You've probably seen it many times. It's a beautiful example of golf at its finest. It's the Augusta National Golf Club.
It's a great choice, and you're right. I was very tempted to put it on. I've had the privilege of walking the course. I haven't played it. I've walked it during Masters Week, and yeah, everything inside the boundaries of Augusta is just exactly you see it on television. The only caveat I would give is until you actually get there and walk it, you have no idea how much elevation change there is in the course.
Yeah, I've heard that before,
especially 18 coming up the hill. It's a hell of a lot steeper than you think. And the same thing with 10 heading into the back nine, it's much more downhill than you think. You don't get that kind of depth on TV. I think Augusta is a great choice, but I'm going to talk about it a little bit more when we get to my number two.
All right.
Number two.
So my number two, I was going to go with the Kirk cheat here and do Augusta and Pebble Beach, but instead I just went with Pebble Beach. Augusta is 2A. I mean, they are neck and neck. There's a great saying among golf circles that says, you want to play Pebble Beach, but you have to play Augusta. But the reason I chose Pebble instead of Augusta was Pebble is the one venue that you can play. You can play it. I can play it. If you've got a spare $600 laying around, you can play this course. That's not the case with Augusta. So I like the fact that it's a venue that we all have access to. And when you leave the golf course, you have the beauty that is Carmel and the Monterey Peninsula all around you to make your entire experience there worthwhile. Once you leave Augusta National, you don't have the same experience. It's all Dunkin' Donuts and Waffle Houses as far as the eye can see. Now, they both have history. You know, you've got the Masters with Augusta, the ghosts of Bobby Jones and Alistair McKenzie. Pebble's got the five U.S. Opens, the Crosby Clam Bake. Challenging layouts. You talked about Amen Corner versus 7, 8, 9 at Pebble. I think Pebble has the better finishing hole. You've got the Magnolias, Pines, and Azaleas at Augusta. You've got the most spectacular setting in the world, Monterey Bay, for Pebble Beach. Jack Nicklaus once called Pebble the course he would play if he only had one more round to play. It's a spectacular course. I've had the privilege of playing it a couple of times. Again, being a Northern California native, you get these opportunities. You tend to be a little bit more biased towards some of them, but I don't know how anybody could deny that Pebble Beach should not be on this top 10 list, and it is my number two.
Interesting choice. Very good choice. In my mind, there are only three golf courses to consider, and Augusta, Pebble, and St. Andrews are those three for me. Personally. Yep. So you can't go wrong. Can't go wrong.
In the tap room after golf, patio overlooking 18 with a beer, looking out at the bay. Doesn't get much better.
Oh, so you're wind aided in your evaluation. You're inebriated.
No, it's aiming fluid.
Okay. Nice. Way to size up that putt. My number two is an old venue. It's not a golf venue. It is a multi-purpose, but mostly football venue. It is the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, the grand old lady, the peristyle and torch. Commissioned in 1929 as a memorial to the vets of World War I, finished in 1923, has a seating capacity of over 93,000. It's the largest in the Pac-12 conference. Home to the University of Southern California football games, was also home to both USC and UCLA from 1928 through 1981. That was kind of fun when that happened, and they'd both wear their home jerseys. Been home to the LA Rams from 1949 to 1979, and again, 2016 to 19. It was a temporary home for the LA Dodgers when they moved out west from 1958 through 1961, and it hosted the World Series there in 1959. Site of the first AFL versus NFL Super Bowl, which was Super Bowl number one, as well as host to Super Bowl VII. Was home for the LA Chargers and the LA Raiders, host to Major League Soccer. It was the main venue for the Summer Olympics twice in 1932 and 1984, and is due for its third Olympics in 2028, 96 years after its first time. It's been home to NCAA Track and Field Championships, Evel Knievel events again, NASCAR, and John F. Kennedy's acceptance speech at the 1960 Democratic Convention. The Coliseum has seen it all. It's done it all. Nobody else can boast three Olympics to host, and it will be there in just a couple years, the LA Coliseum.
I saw the Rolling Stones there with Guns N' Roses opening up for them.
Me too. You were sitting right next to me.
Oh, that's right. We did go together. I may have had a drink that night.
And do you remember it was raining on us? And do you remember who the ultimate or the first opening band was before Guns N' Roses came out?
Living Color.
Ding, 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 ding. Very good.
Yeah. It's a good choice. I did not put it on my list. It's not my number one. I'd still...
Surprise!
I know. This is a little bit of Bay Area coming out in me, a little bit of SC hater coming out in me, and a lot of the surrounding neighborhood sucks coming out in me.
I know, but I'm not evaluating the surrounding neighborhood. There's so much dang history in this place. It, like I said, three Olympics, dudes.
There is.
Three Olympics.
Absolutely. And I love the the trivia that it's one of the few, if not only, venue to ever host a World Series and a Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool. It's a good choice. Again, when we get to our Unlisted, the sequel, that's be the one of the ones I'd bring up. But I can absolutely see why it's on your list, Homer. Nice choice.
Yeah, if I was a true Homer, my number one would be Wrigley Field, but I did not do that. All right, that brings us into the penultimate.
The Big Kahuna, the top dog, the best of the best, number one.
Funny you should say what you just said, because my number one is Wrigley Field and Fenway Park.
Ah, here it is. He saved it.
Now, I'm not doing this as a tie. Hold on. This is not a cheat. I'm not presenting this as a tie. I'm presenting this as the equivalent baseball experience represented in two very distinctly different cities, but share a lot of the same things that qualify them as my number one. History is one of the most important things to baseball than any other American sport. The ballparks are remnants of another time, connecting generations of fans and ballplayers who've come to these places to celebrate this game for more than 100 years. I pulled that off the internet, so it reads very well, but it's absolutely true. We go to ballparks to watch games and to have that shared experience. There are certain ballparks you go to because they are the park, not because the team's good. You go there because they are that park. They are that experience. Fenway and Wrigley are at the top of that list. As much as I do love Oracle, I can't picture Willie Mays playing at Oracle because he never did. But Williams, Yastrzemski, Rice, Ruth, they all played at Fenway. Banks, Williams, Santo, Wilson, Tinkers, Devers, DeChance, they were all at Wrigley. You can picture that. That's where they played. Their ghosts are still there. The downtown neighborhood feeling is a big part of both of the ballparks, whether it's Waverly and Wrigleyville or it's Yawkey Way. And the ballparks have a ton in common. They both have curses. Do any other ballparks in the majors have curses? The curse of the Bambino and the curse of the goat. And I don't think it's a coincidence that these were long suffering World Series teams as well. These ballparks are built with very few creature comforts. They're meant for watching a game with a hot dog, a beer, and a scorebook for fans who truly love baseball. And their traditions with each park are incredibly rich. In Chicago, Harry Carey, take me out to the ball game. Ivy covered walls, throwing back the home run balls, flying the W. Addison, Clark, Sheffield, and Waveland. No, that's not a legal firm. Those are the streets surrounding the ballpark. In Boston, you've got Yawkey Way, the Green Monster, Sweet Caroline, Dirty Water, Curse of the Bambino, Pesky's Pole. All of this comes together to create that wonderful tapestry of baseball. Everything we love about the movie The Natural is represented in fields like this. They have to be number one as a baseball fan. For me, these are the parks that represent the epitome of what the baseball experience is. So my number one is the Fenway Park / Wrigley Field experience.
That's not a venue. That's an experience.
At a venue.
Okay.
Still
an experience. And you know what? Great choice. And I love what you're saying about them. But on behalf of fellow Cub fans and all my Boston Red Sox fans, there ain't no more curse anymore. Those curses are gone, dude.
No, there isn't. Neither one, but they existed. And again, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that one park is better than the other. I'm just saying they're very similar experiences that really don't exist that much anymore in Major League Baseball.
Yes. One park, though, is a little better than the other because one park was crammed into their neighborhood so much so that the dimensions don't work. But I'm just saying.
That's what makes them baseball.
Yes. And Fenway probably would have made my list if I didn't put the Astrodome on there, because I consider that, even though it's a multi-purpose, it has such a rich history in baseball with the Astros. I just was like, okay, I don't know if I can put a fourth thing here. And I wanted to celebrate the first dome because domes are such a prevalent part of our sports scene now. Good choice on your part and well said.
Isn't that like celebrating patient zero?
No. My number one is one of the things that was on your unlisted, but it is definitely of the same thought process that you just had for your number one of the experience of baseball. And that is Old Yankee Stadium, the house that Ruth built, the home of DiMaggio, the Mick, and Mr. October. Being a baseball fan, or maybe being a fan of any American, you know, major sport, you're aware that there's maybe no place that has held as much mystique as old Yankee Stadium. From the frieze, which is the facade, they call it the frieze, I think is how you pronounce it. From that on the roof to the Monument Park and the retired numbers, the place really has earned its nickname as the Cathedral of Baseball. So many historic players, both Yankees and visitors, have played there. So many historic moments from games were created there. Every season seemed to add to the lore of the place, the mystique, the music, the bleacher creatures, the meeting at the bat. Wrigley Field and Fenway Park are iconic for sure, but old Yankee Stadium was the symbol of the great American pastime for decades. There's just a couple more ghosts floating around there from a couple more successful ventures. That's why I got my nod at number one, old Yankee Stadium.
This was probably the toughest one I debated because I thought about making a three-way tie between Fenway, Wrigley, and old Yankee Stadium, but I thought that would even push you over the limit. So I decided not to do it. My tiebreaker honestly was you can still go to Fenway and Wrigley and you can't go to old Yankee Stadium anymore. So that was my tiebreaker. And that was the reason I elevated it a little higher, but very worthy to be on there as a baseball fan. How could it not be?
Right. Exactly. All right. Well, good list. I thought we'd be varied, and varied we were. We had no exact matches. Go figure. Yeah, if you're counting the Wrigley Field element of your number one, then we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 common matches. So you predicted it. You won both. Good job.
Woohoo!
All right. Well, that brings us to
Unlisted, the sequel.
And as we do every week, Unlisted the Sequel gives us an opportunity to throw out a little more love to some honorable mentions of, in this case, venues that didn't quite make the list. Who's on your Unlisted the Sequel?
Well, as we talked about, old Yankee Stadium, that one was the one I wrestled with for a little while until I came to that tiebreaker of you can still visit one, but not the other. The LA Coliseum, I'll be honest, I probably should have found room for it on there somewhere. I just couldn't do it.
You were breaking out in a rash.
truly. I needed some ointment. And Churchill Downs was kind of floating around out there, but I gotta be honest. And I think it helped that you were there. You actually went to Churchill Downs. I've never been there. I only know it from the one event that it happened. So the thought that kept spinning in my head was, okay, what happens the other 51 weeks out of the year? You know, is it still that special? So is it kind of like, as I mentioned before, is it like a Brigadoon? You know, it appears and is useful and then goes away. So that's why I didn't put it up there when I wanted to look at some of the other things that were out there, the multi-purpose stuff, and even get a little bit more European or even Australian. Mm-hmm. So those are three. And I got to admit, the Astrodome was never on my radar. I always, you know, every time you'd hear an athlete talk about it, they just hated it. So I kind of got a bias out of that.
Yeah,
for pitchers.
Yeah, because it was the mold of what was to come. It was a living glimpse of the future. That's why I made it. And I got to tell you, I gave half a thought to the Toronto Sky Dome or whatever it's called nowadays, because it was the first retractable roof stadium. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that entered in my thought too. Fenway, of course, AT&T Park for sure. But I also considered Oriole Park at Camden Yards, as well. Cause it, I think kind of by definition is the first of the new wave breaking the cookie cutter mold that baseball had been in for such a long time.
Yeah.
Madison Square Garden for sure. Lambeau Field, and Old Boston Garden, Montreal Forum that I mentioned before. And also in the world of soccer, Barcelona's Camp Nou got consideration, as did Rio's Maracanã Stadium.
Yeah.
The Bird's Nest, which was on your unlisted, I'm glad you pulled that out too. That's quite an interesting stadium with how it's constructed in the light show. And
I got to admit, you know, I was drawn to it, but it seemed like everything that was written about it was always about the architecture as opposed to what had happened inside of it. And that to me was the defining kind of the tipping point on the Bird's Nest.
Right. But it does have the moniker of host being the only venue to host a winter and a summer Olympics, which it has done now with the past winter Olympics.
Very true.
All right. Well, very good. That pretty much wraps it up for our greatest sports venues. We don't have a guest this week, which we knew we were not going to, but it does give us a chance for
It's the time filler. Bonus material.
A little bonus material, which we like to call after further review. No, we're not checking a monitor to see if the play was called right or not. We are checking ourselves about lists from the past and shows from the past and things that we might have done a little differently upon further reflection and time spent in a corner.
Further review.
Kirk, why don't you start us off since you started the other list off as well?
Upon further review, from episode 33, our best composers, the one we did two episodes ago, I'm actually going to take out Hans Zimmer and I'm going to put in Elmer Bernstein. I think I mentioned this even when we were doing the show. Mm-hmm. But what really brought it home for me was, I don't know if you've seen the new Batman movie, the new Robert Pattinson, Matt Reeves Batman movie.
I have.
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I liked the film noir approach they took with the Batman and that, you know, that whole world's greatest detective moniker or nickname that he has was brought into play a little bit more. But something that our friend Chris Ledesma said really kind of stuck in my head. And that was at the end of the movie, I don't remember a Batman theme. I can't remember the music from the movie at all. And music, and this is Michael Giacchino. This is a great composer, but I don't remember any of the stuff that was in the movie. And music is such an important part of the motion picture experience that it was really kind of disappointing. And the more we thought about it and we talked about it, and I did a little more research, you know, people really are kind of putting Hans Zimmer, fairly or unfairly, at the forefront of this move away from melody and into just kind of a pulsating drone to push movies along. So with that in mind, I decided, you know what, if he's going to be responsible, if he's the tip of the sword, if you're listening, Hans, sorry, I know it's probably not you, but I get it. I'm going to bring in Elmer Bernstein, who you had on your list and you made such a great case for, but it was even more striking when you think about, this is the guy who did The Magnificent Seven, The Great Escape. He also did Ghostbusters and Animal House. I mean, talk about a variety, talk about an impact. The guy had like a 50-year career. He was one of those composers that was really good before composers were celebrities. You know, he made his niche before the Mancinis and the Williams of the world, before they were elevated to superstar status. So I want to give Elmer Bernstein a ton of credit. So Elmer Bernstein goes into my top 10 for best composers, and Hans Zimmer, sorry, brother. You're waiting your turn.
Wow. Poor Hans.
Yeah.
When I go to visit Hans in Europe, you're not invited.
Hans Zimmer is now Hans Gruber.
Oh, dang. I see Hans Zimmer falling, that shot of him falling from the building. my first after further review is from episode 26, our fast food restaurants thing. This is funny. I went back and did a little post episode sampling again, and my number two, Pizza Hut, fell down a couple notches. Just didn't quite hold up as well as it used to in my mind. And it dropped in a free fall down to number six, which moved Mod Pizza up to number two, Wendy's up to number three, Jersey Mike's up to number four, and Panda Express up to number five. So Pizza Hut taking the big fall from two to six.
I guess somebody does out Pizza the Hut.
You love that joke.
I do.
All right. What's your next after further review?
Well, my second after further review is bound to put a smile on your face, because I'm going to go back to episode 13, best cities to visit, and New Orleans, you're out. Chicago, you're in.
Yay.
I had a ton of friends lobby me very successfully to include Chicago, including my good friend George Roth. And here is what he sent me to convince me. He said, Kirkles, my nickname from high school, we're going to Chicago, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to have dinner on the best ribs on the planet at Twin Anchors, grab a beer at Mother's while we're waiting, blues at Kingston Mines, breakfast at Ann Swather's the next day, Broughton beer at Murphy's Bleachers, game at Wrigley, post-game music at the Cubby Bear Lounge, dinner at some of the finest restaurants in the world, pick one, wake up, run along Lake Michigan, walk and shop and lunch the Magnificent Mile, check out Grant Park and the Shedd Aquarium, another great dinner, drive up to the to Lake Forest the next day, swim Lake Michigan, take the architectural cruise out to Lake Michigan at night, and then get X-faced on Rush Street drinking upside-down margaritas. That sounds like a party. So New Orleans, you're out. Chicago, you're in.
Yeah, and he didn't even get to the Museum of Science and Industry or Field Museum or so many other places. State Street, yeah.
Or the Chicago Athletic Association, right, or the Pump Street, yeah, or the Billy Goat Tavern. You know, it goes on and on and on.
Soldier Field.
I fully admit it. New Orleans, I love you. But here's the other thing. You can go to Chicago for a week. If you're in New Orleans more than two nights, you need bail money.
I've done it. I stayed out of jail. But only it was only three nights, so it wasn't a big stretch. Man. All right. My next, after further review, was from episode 32, The Women of History. You won me over with the person that I was kind of straddling the fence anyway, and Eleanor Roosevelt, you're on the list. Cleopatra, sayonara. Let's face it, Cleopatra was famous for being famous. She had her privilege.
Was she the Kim Kardashian of ancient history?
The Zsa Zsa Gabor or Kim Kardashian of history, yes. So, Cleopatra, you can kiss my asp. You're out of here. And Eleanor Roosevelt and all of the good things you did, you're in on my greatest women of history. Congratulations.
Very nice. Very nice. I would agree. Cleopatra's a bit of a lightweight. And Eleanor Roosevelt did some good stuff. So I appreciate that. All right. Should we do one more?
Let's do one more.
All right. My third after further review is from episode 23, the best James Bond films. Out is the film No Time to Die, the latest James Bond film. And in is Thunderball. John Lovett of the great podcast Love It or Leave It had this quote. One of the best Bond films I've ever seen is the first half of No Time to Die. And one of the worst Bond films I've ever seen is the second half of No Time to Die. And I could not agree more. When we did the Bond podcast, we had both just seen the film. So it was kind of fresh, still kind of shiny, still kind of new. You know, ooh, wasn't that great? We saw a bit. But after living with it for a little bit, man, there's just so much about this movie I don't like. The villain was terrible.
Which one?
Blofeld's death, Rami Malek. That character was terrible. Blofeld's death was terrible. It finished the arc that was started in Casino Royale, ended with this film. So it was a five-film arc, which I'm not crazy about as a James Bond format. But you realize he was given the 00 in Casino Royale, and his career ended in the last one. And all we really did was focus on this one story. Bond was so much more than that. It was just really disappointing. To me, the only reason the ending occurred the way it did, and I'm not spoiling it for people who haven't seen it, is to me, the producers need something for somebody, for the people who saw it to talk about, to help keep momentum going until they can get the franchise fired up again. I thought it was a really disappointing ending at the end of the day. Here's the funny thing. I thought Hans Zimmer did a pretty good job on the score, but he was also working with all the old James Bond themes. It wasn't anything new that he did. So I'm sorry. No Time to Die, you're out. And Thunderball, you're the workhorse, you're Sean Connery, you're, you know, 100% pure Bond, you're going in.
Wow. Poor No Time to Die.
Oh my God. Seriously. If I had just, I went to the bathroom halfway through the movie, and if I had just left, I would have thought it was a great movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, you should have done that.
Ooh.
Done us all a favor.
Ooh.
All right. My last further review is something that will make you happy, I think. It's from episode 27, the singer-songwriter category. Thinking about it a little more, when you pitched this originally, you didn't say it in so many words, but then thinking back, going, okay, I know Kirk better than this. I should have grasped on that. You were talking more about a feel, more of a genre within the music industry of what a singer-songwriter is. So where I do not apologize for Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen and guys like that, because I think they are legitimate, fantastic writers. I did a little shuffling and I switched Billy Joel and Paul Simon. Billy Joel was number five. He moves up to my Mount Rushmore, number three. Paul Simon moves down to number five. David Bowie becomes the odd man out, who was my number six, because even though as much as I think he's inventive and was completely different from anybody else and does write great music, he doesn't anywhere come close to the vein of what I think you were imagining as a singer-songwriter. So David goodbye, which makes everybody else on the list move up. Neil Diamond, Carole King, Jim Croce, John Denver, and adds James Taylor to my list officially. So JT, welcome to the club. There we go.
Christmas comes early this year. Good job. Hey, I've got a blind side for you.
Blind side.
Uh-oh.
What actor do you think would make the best new James Bond?
I didn't give this a lot of thought, but I got to tell you, under quick thought, when my son and I were talking about this, I'm kind of leaning a little toward Tom Hiddleston.
I love that. That was my answer too. I'd love Idris Elba. He might be getting a little old for
That's
the role.
What I thought.
Not that he's old, but for the role. Yeah. But, you know, and I know everybody thinks of Hiddleston as Loki and the mischievous one and, you know, all that nonsense. But I think, you know, given the right tuxedo, the drink in the hand, I think he could be perfect as Bond.
Yeah, I think he would get back a little too more like what Pierce Brosnan was and what Roger Moore could be at times, but especially Pierce, that a little more sleek, suave, debonair, but you still believe the physicality with Pierce. You know, that's why I think made Pierce so great. Timothy Dalton also pulled that off too. So they weren't quite as formidable looking as Connery and especially Daniel Craig, but you're still going to believe that they can handle themselves physically in a fight, in a tough situation.
Yeah, I'm not talking about swinging the pendulum all the way back. I mean, obviously, Daniel Craig gave us the more gruff, you know, hard-boiled Bond.
Yeah.
And I don't want to swing it all the way back over to Moore. I want to find that happy medium. And I think Hiddleston could be that guy. As my dark horse, I think Orlando Bloom might not be a bad choice.
Seems a little thin and everything to me, but we've seen before that he can definitely handle physicality. I didn't even think about that one. That's interesting. Interesting choice.
I'll tell you who I don't want. I don't want Tom Hardy. I don't want Tom Holland. I don't want Henry Cavill. And I don't want Robert Pattinson.
Yeah, absolutely. On all four. Check, 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 check. But, you know, Sir Anthony Hopkins was looking pretty spry in the Oscars the other night. Just kidding.
That's true.
All right. Well, that's a pretty full episode for us. We covered a subject, a little bonus material, a little blindside, and I think that will wrap it up. So next time, you won't want to miss it because we're going to go back into the world of food, and we're going to talk about candy bars / movie theater candy. We'll have a special guest.
Make sure you brush thoroughly after.
Exactly. 9 out of 10 dentists say, don't listen to this episode. But what do they know?
What do they know? They only went to school for 12 years. Anyway, you and 3 out of 5 dentists can find us on Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Google, iHeartRadio, Pandora, or wherever you go to get your quality podcasts. We're a member of the Buzzsprout community, and Populist is a Vintage Year production.
And wherever you do listen to us, we're always grateful when you give us a 5-star rating or can leave us a favorable review and some nice kind words. We do appreciate it. Helps us grow the audience, and which helps us grow the show. You can find us on Buzzsprout at populist.buzzsprout.com, on facebook.com/populistpod, or on Twitter at populist_pod. Thanks so much for listening. We appreciate each and every one of you. We hope you enjoy the show. We think you'll enjoy the next one as well. So until then, bye-bye. Stay safe. See you soon.
Thanks, everybody. We had a ball.
See ya.